Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today's show is going to be off the charts. We have three guests with us today. We have Anne Friedman, who's a journalist who writes for multiple publications, including The New Yorker, Time, and Newsweek, who's going to be coming on the show today to talk with us. Then we've got Tom Berman, and is going to be talking to us about his time as a strategist for multiple campaigns, and we'll be discussing the Anthony Weiner case with him. Then we have Robbie Kramer, who is a dating coach, and will be talking to us about his advice for men. So let's not waste any time. We've got a full rundown. We're going to start out with our dating news of the week, then move into the Hollywood Report, get in touch with Anne, and then talk with Tom Berman, followed by talking with Robbie, and then we're going to end with my dating advice of the week on the top five don'ts on a first date. All right, y'all, let's get it on. In dating news of the week, all right, I'm always looking at YouTube videos and Facebook, and a friend of mine posted a really interesting video that he saw on YouTube of a woman approaching a guy and asking him whether or not she wants to have sex with him. What's interesting about this is that she didn't just ask one man to have sex with her, but rather asked several men to have sex with her. This video is labeled as a cultural experiment, and the counterpart to this video is one in which a man approaches several women and asks them as well whether or not they would like to have sex with him. While fairly bold, her actions are not uncommon. Well, maybe in a social space, but not in an academic space. So studies conducted by researchers to understand whether or not there are differences in the receptivity to sexual advances differs by gender have been going on for quite some time. Essentially, researchers have wanted to examine whether or not cultural stereotypes that men are far more desirous of sex than women are still operative. Granted, these studies first started almost 30 years ago and are quite popular and still in the general literature. However, they're problematic because they use convenient samples of college students. So we don't really know how older adults would act if they were asked whether or not they wanted to go home with a stranger. But by and large, despite many studies and books that have come out in the recent past, our understanding is that women have had this lower sex drive than their male counterparts. And female sexuality has largely been diminished because of that. So a lot of authors recently, like Daniel Bergner, have really tried to dispel this myth in their books like What Women Want. What was interesting about these studies, though, is that they confirm these cultural stereotypes. So we wanted to be able to see, is that still the case? And I guess that's what this video updates. The types of responses that the men get from the women and the types of responses that the women receive from the men are rather not shocking. Most people just say no thanks. One guy, however, says to her in a scene that's quite funny and very amusing to me because this guy is exactly my type. He says to her, "I'm sorry, I'm on the phone with my mother," tells his mom that he'll call her back, and then says he'll have to respectfully decline her offer. He seems very flustered, but finds it somewhat flattering, I think. In the video in which you see the guy asking the women whether or not they'd like to have sex with him, one girl throws a drink in his face and is just completely and totally shocked and, I guess, feels completely disrespected by his actions. I think the most interesting thing, though, is that when the guy was in a group of other individuals and approaching a woman, he asked whether or not the men in the group were dating the woman, and then proceeded to ask the woman the question after all of the men had said they were not. So at this point, I had assumed that this was a sign of respect or fear of being assaulted. However, in subsequent groups, when women were accompanied by men, he would ask the woman whether or not she wanted to sleep with him, regardless of the response of the guys. So apparently, these individuals show no shame or respect for pre-existing relationships. The woman, when she approached men with other women, didn't even ask the question. So that was quite interesting to me. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty. The male had no success with the women. The male had 50% success with the women. The male had no success with the woman who he asked, but he had, but the woman experienced a 50% success rate. So the larger point of all of this is that this study was conducted approximately 30 years ago, but we still see the patterns emerging. Why are men so much more willing than their female counterparts to engage in this type of behavior? 30 years ago, the study was still not able to ask the question or answer this question, why do the women say no to the men, to their sexual advances, and why do the men agree to go out with the women? So I think that this probably has to do with many things. I think that this probably has to do that men are more sexually motivated than women, and women are seeking a higher degree of commitment. While that's not saying that women are not sexually motivated, their need for commitment may override their sexual desire to go home with a stranger and be sexually satisfied. So we'll see what happens. I think that another study that's potentially more scientific should be done that could update this. All right. So we all know that I talked about speed dating quite frequently on the show. A couple weeks ago, I talked about this really interesting story that I covered on a speed dating site called On Speed Dating, where individuals, and more specifically women, had to demonstrate that they were a certain level of physical attractiveness as measured either by their cup size, and I'm talking about their breasts, not, you know, something that's being regulated by New York City for Coca-Cola, or their dress size, so being a size 8 or below. So while I thought this service was fairly shocking, I was really surprised to learn about a new form of speed dating. There's this site in London that allows people to meet and communicate, but they don't actually use words. Shh Dating, the name of the site, yes, Shh Dating, holds events in which daters provide information to prospective partners, not using words, but rather just body language and sounds like In the first part of the two-minute date, the daters are instructed to make sounds and use their hands to communicate for the other 60 seconds of this two-minute date. Essentially, they're just supposed to look at each other for the 60 seconds. I know that if there were Americans there, the silence would not be good because we'd all be really impressed by the British accents, but these individuals live in Britain, so maybe they're used to the accents by now. Arguably, however, listening and picking up on these nonverbal cues, such as facial expressions, is a very good dating skill, but you don't actually learn anything about the individual. Very critical information like their values, their education, their sense of humor can be assessed pretty quickly. So while interesting conceptually, I'm way too talkative to survive at a two-hour event where I would have to not be able to talk and would probably have to duct tape my mouth shut for most of it to be able to maintain the type of premise that these people are doing. So, next story. A friend and listener of the show posted a really interesting story on my Facebook page this week. The article that she posted was related to a topic that I've discussed a great deal on the show, market dynamics in dating. No, not the S&P, not the Dow Jones, but rather how individuals stack up to other individuals in the dating scene. I've often asserted that individuals arrive on the dating market with a relatively good idea of how they measure up. However, there's now an actual test or formula that women can use to assess their market value. The criteria of this test include both demographic, intellectual characteristics, behavior, but there's certainly a larger emphasis on the physical characteristics. Of course, it's about women and judging women. Some of the physical characteristics include, you know, how large is your nose? What is your body mass index? What is the distance between your eyes? But there's some behavioral questions as well. How often do you curse, which I think is very interesting. And I think that women who curse often turn off men and are considered uneducated and uncouth or unfeminine for doing so, which is probably part of the calculus. They're also asked, you know, when someone gets hurt, are you the first to ask if they're okay and deliver aid if needed, trying to assess whether or not a woman is nurturing or feminine. Also, there are sexual questions, you know, assessing how many different types of sexual positions you regularly engage in, as well as your perception of different types of sexual acts. And while some of these questions are fairly gendered, as well, like, do you participate in co-ed sports or are you competitive? That's particularly problematic. Potentially, men might be more interested in a more alpha female, so but are penalized for their responses that might be slightly less feminine in nature. And based upon your answers to all of these questions, you either receive a point, receive no points, or lose points. And there's variation by question and points. So, for example, with the age question, you could receive 10 points for being between the ages of 18 to 22, and then 6 points for being between the ages of 23 and 25, for example. Ultimately, you add up all of the answers, and then you get your desirability ranking. I'd argue that this method is flawed in many ways, as I've already mentioned. Different communities, as we know, have different perceptions of beauty. There's also variation by individuals in what they find to be attractive. Also, I would argue that this test is sort of unnecessary because individuals are already aware of how they stack up in the dating market because it's operative. You're either receiving dates and advances or you're not. The market's working. We don't necessarily need this test. And granted, while it was very fun to calculate my score, I found it to be deeply disturbing. And more importantly, the most intelligent and assertive women, alpha females, lost points, which is just not good in my book. I guess I've always been interested in romance and love stories. This led to my interest in fairy tales as a young child. One of my favorite stories, however, had nothing to do with love and was actually The Emperor's New Clothes. The basic premise of this story is that you're trying to assess whether or not the clothes make the man. And while this story is designed for children, it could be highly relevant in the dating world. Do the clothes make the man? In one study, according to Arden Reed and OkCupid, the clothes really do make the man. Whether navy black or gray flannel, I'm a sucker for a man in a suit, and apparently a lot of other women are too. According to this study, men who wore the more tailored suits are more likely to receive messages and responses from women. So OkCupid essentially created two fake profiles in which they had all the same information, but the men were just dressed differently. In one of the profiles, the man was wearing this boxy, off-the-rack suit, and in the other, something slim, fitted, tailored, and he looks like he could have been James Bond. But women obviously responded to the sexy James Bond. They were far more likely to respond to his messages and were more likely to reach out to him. In fact, 3.5 times more women were more likely to send an unsolicited message, and 2.5 more times more women were more likely to just visit his profile. I also wanted to mention really quickly a lovely radio program that I listen to regularly and an interesting story I heard. So the program I listen to is Fresh Air on with Terry Gross. And my dream is one day that I can go on her show and talk about my book. And I would unabashedly tell her on the air that I was giddy as a schoolgirl to be on her show. The book, however, that she talked about this week was related to The Masters of Sex, Virginia Johnson and Bill Masters. And the book's now been developed into a TV show. Bill Masters and Virginia Johnson pioneered sex studies and really opened up the medical field to studying sex in a more scientific way. The rather remarkable thing was that for their time, they would observe individuals having sex to understand how individuals please their partners and sexual dysfunction. You should all go ahead and listen to her podcast with Thomas Mayer about this issue and this book. All right, y'all, that's our dating news of the week. Now our Hollywood report. Be right back. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had our dating news of the week. Now we're going to get into our Hollywood report. Okay, so Helen of Troy had a face that could launch 1,000 ships. Katy Perry apparently believes that her breasts are capable of causing major issues for relationships. Rumor has it that last May, Katy Perry and Robert Pattinson were seeing each other. However, Katy Perry and Robert Pattinson were not, in fact, seeing each other. It was her understanding, though, that Kristen Stewart, who had been involved with Pattinson for quite some time, was upset with her. So she sent her a text message saying, "I know you've seen all this stuff, but you know I would never disrespect you. I'm not that type of person. I'm just trying to be a friend to him, but it's unfortunate that I also have a set of breasts." This was appeared in Elle in the UK, and then was later reported in People magazine. I would argue that Katy Perry obviously has excellent conflict resolution skills. Even celebrities have a hard time dating. According to Cher, who's dated Val Kilmer, Eric Stoltz, and Tom Cruise, finds that navigating the dating scene right now isn't really easy. Cher is 67 years old and says that she often forgets her own age. I must say that it becomes much harder to date as you get older, and 67 is certainly getting up there. However, I know that there are lots of older people who are divorced, widowed, and looking for love. So maybe you'll find it, Cher. I'm a dating coach. Call me. All right, it's official. 21-year-old Taylor Lautner is dating 27-year-old co-star Marie Evangelopoulos. So while Twilight fans across America will be upset, I'm more interested in discussing why this 27-year-old woman is dating the 21-year-old guy, and whether or not she can be considered a cougar, as many people would recognize it, or a wildcat, as my mother and now the Dr. Jess community recognizes cougars as wildcats. So is dating someone who's 6 years younger when you are in your 20s and a woman considered a large enough gap to be getting wildcat status? What's the official number of years that must be between a man and a woman to be considered a cougar? Let me know your thoughts on my Facebook page, Hook Up with Dr. Jess. We're going to play a little bit more music and then get back with Ann Friedman. Be right back, y'all.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today we have Ann Friedman, who is a writer for multiple publications, including Newsweek, who's here to tell us about her recent article about rape going viral. Hi, Ann. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Dr. Jess. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great.
So I found this article to be really interesting, and I think our listeners will as well. I wanted to start out by talking about videos or photos that have been posted online of sexual assault in the recent past and how that might be helpful for law enforcement to prosecute crimes. The most recent case that I can think of that was really on the national scene was the Steubenville rape case, which I know that you talked about a lot in the article.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think what's important to note is that, like, normally these photos and you know, sort of other social media, like maybe like tweets describing the assault or things like that, are circulated among social groups or friend groups.
Yes.
And it's only been in a handful of cases, usually with the intervention of the hacker group Anonymous, where those photos and videos have sort of like gotten broader attention beyond just with, you know, minor social circles. So
yeah.
That's, like, one thing to sort of keep in mind. Yeah.
No, that's an interesting point, this dynamic of that it's a social group circulating. It's not just a person, you know, posting a photo, that it's actually being posted to a group.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting to think about for the purpose of perpetuating an idea. Is it to perpetuate this idea that rape and sexual assault is acceptable? Is it to try to get some type of affirmation? That's really interesting to think about.
Well, one of the experts I interviewed made the observation that, you know, because rape is a crime of power more than a crime of sex, it really has more to do with, you know, the people involved in these crimes sort of bragging about them or, like, further demonstrating that power by sharing evidence, essentially, with other people. And that's happened, you know, for decades before social media. Basically, like, you know, as long as there have been cameras and, you know, video recorders, attackers have been keeping records of their crimes, essentially. It's only now that we sort of have more of a way to tap into that, and all of us are sort of getting a means to see these things that they previously only shared among sort of like a group of people they were bragging to, essentially.
Yes, no, I mean, I you hear about people who commit these types of crimes having some type of souvenir so that they could potentially relive the event. But I was talking to somebody about domestic violence issues last week and talking about the consequences of posting things online related to the attacks that they've made against their partner. Obviously, individuals know that person is dating the other person, but in this case, they just know that this person engaged in some type of assault. What's interesting, though, is that how overt these messages are and that they could potentially be caught by posting it. I mean, theoretically, if an individual who commits the crimes posting it, it's different from an individual who's a bystander that's posting it.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, we see, I mean, just, we all use social media, you know how it works. Sometimes you'll tweet or post about a thing that happens in your own life or that you witness directly, and sometimes you'll respond to or share something that, you know, a friend has seen or created, or sometimes it's like 4 degrees removed. And I think that's where, you know, maybe it sounds a little crass, but from both an activist perspective and just from sort of, you know, someone who pays attention to, as someone who pays attention to digital culture, like, mm-hmm. this starts to get interesting, and really is new and different as opposed to sort of the phenomenon of, horrible attackers documenting rape, 20 years ago.
Of course, of course. And that's the really interesting element, that people cross this line of a very private act becoming public to millions of people. It's not just exclusive to that friend group, as you said, but it could be seen throughout the world.
I don't think they're thinking about that. I don't think that, when those, boys in Steubenville were making videos joking about the attack, that they thought that those were going to be circulated beyond, a couple of friends they were laughing with.
Oh,
like, no. They had no idea.
Yeah, no. Yeah. They certainly, I'm sure, did not have the foresight, as you said, to make that type of assumption at all. Presumably, if they would, they wouldn't have posted it. Or maybe they would. Maybe they thought they were above any type of prosecution. Presumably, when you commit that type of act, you do think that you are above that.
Yeah. It's true. And I think that, if they thought that this was something that there was a lot of accountability for, they wouldn't have done it. I think that there is a perception of we're behind closed doors and we're in control here. Again, it's sort of a crime of power, and it probably does not occur to them that the fact that they're documenting this crime is going to come back and hold them accountable for it.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. But now that we've talked about the attackers a little bit, I wanted to delve into the victims of the assault and the multiple ways that they're traumatized following the assault. It's not just about the rape, but you talk a lot about other ways that there's continued trauma for victims following this attack.
Yeah, it's really easy for us to sort of assume, when we talk about this phenomenon broadly, that when you see a photo of a girl who's sort of, whose body is slack, she's clearly passed out or not totally coherent, and you see, guys who are sort of laughing and taking advantage of her, that there's no other way to read that than assault, but in reality, dating back, to the pre-social media era as well, a lot of times this, these photos and videos are used to try to discredit the victim, and to say, she's kind of coherent, or it seems like, I really don't to pick apart her story even further, and it becomes, it tends to exacerbate the problem that has long, dogged the criminal justice system, which is that because there are so many negative effects to coming forward and naming your attackers, women are really disincentivized to pursue legal action against these people, and social media exacerbates all those problems.
Oh, absolutely. I think about what you talked about in your article regarding Serena Williams and discussing the young woman and how she was drunk and what were her parents doing and what was she wearing. That's been going on for years, and that's, for victims of rape, when they say that, this woman was dressed provocatively, she clearly deserved it, and obviously no one ever deserves to be a victim of sexual assault or rape or any type of harassment for how they appear to be dressed or are acting. It's completely and totally unacceptable. You may not be perceived well by others, and that's a fair judgment, but you never deserve, obviously, to be the victim of an attack.
Well, I think it's telling that we never say those rapists were so drunk.
Yeah.
Which is actually a really common phenomenon. There's not a public awareness campaign for parents of teenage boys to sit them down and be like, okay, if you're going to be drinking tonight, don't rape. We tend to sort of put, even before anything happens, the onus on potential victims as opposed to potential attackers. So, and I think that, sometimes we'd like to believe that these photos and videos could sort of flip that script a little bit. And the conclusion that I came to is maybe not as much as we'd like to believe they would.
Sure. And the point about you're saying that parents should advise their sons not to rape, that goes beyond the scope of a possibility in a parent's mind that their child would be even capable of that. So I think that's why it's not part of the public dialogue. I think that parents sit down with their daughter others and tell them to be careful about drinking and how that may affect their judgment and potentially being wary of young men when they are under the influence of alcohol. But I don't think that conversation is had with young men, as you put. Also, this point about never talking about the rapist being drunk publicly, I think that's an interesting point, but I think that women who are the victims of sexual assault think about that when they are trying to decide whether to report it. You know, they think about, should I come forward? Is this man drunk? You know, he was drunk. He didn't really mean to do it. And they don't want to come forward generally. So it gives them another reason not to make a statement.
Well, yeah, I mean, I also think, too, that, you know, we're talking about this right now in this sort of very clear, level-headed way. I mean, this is a really, like, brutal crime that, like, that, you know, like, I think that the you know, if you talk to victims advocates, the dominant sentiment expressed by most victims of sexual assault is, like, I just want it to go away. I want it to feel like it never happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, and pursuing, you know, a legal case is the antithesis of that. So I think that, you know, like, there's a lot of factors working here that are both personal and, like, on a societal level, for sure.
Of course, of course. I was also curious about the policy of websites for posting this material related to sexual violence, rape, and assault. You talk about how there's a lot of variation across social media sites like Twitter and Facebook with regards to this type of speech, and obviously it's a speech issue, given that these videos are documenting some type of act.
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of social media sites say that the onus is on users to post material that is, you know, that complies with the law. And really there's nothing in sort of the terms of service with, you know, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, you know, being sort of like those two big ones, and even Facebook, that says you can't use our service if you post explicit materials like this. Even with a Facebook, which sort of has this, you know, anti-hate speech policy, which would in theory make it not okay to post material like this, it's really difficult to enforce. You know, and I think that, like, that's one thing to keep in mind. Even if we all decided we were okay with having these platforms say we're going to judge what is and isn't, you know, too sexually explicit, or what is or isn't endorsing a crime, even then there's sort of a problem of, look, like, you know, it's I think that, you know, I heard in the piece that it's like whack-a-mole, like, it'll just sort of keep cropping up.
Sure.
And also, you know, how do you tell the difference as an administrator or as, like, a community manager? You know, I'm posting Steubenville links because I'm like, this is horrible. Everybody needs to pay attention and call on the district attorney to act, versus, haha, this is so funny. You know, like, those things, like, you know, there's not really a clear-cut way to sort of perform a search for that. So I really think that, like, you know, like as with a lot of things when it comes to rape, we're looking at, you know, broader cultural change as really sort of like the primary tool for fighting it, not so much a front end getting websites to sort of curtail you know, the amount of the stuff that is posted.
No, yes, that's really interesting. You and I have talked about this before, about, you know, what are the rights of victims? What if a victim doesn't want to have their assault be posted online? Do they have any recourse? Are they able to take action to really protect themselves? You discussed the idea of lawsuits being a major possibility in the future for these victims to advocate for themselves if they want to have that crime that occurred against them, as you said, just go away in their minds and their heads and not have it be so public.
Yeah, there have been a couple of cases. I forget if this made it into the final article or not, but there was definitely one victim who, after her university, you know, just sort of gave her the men who raped her, like, a slap on the wrist. She publicized their names on Twitter and broadcast, you know, these are the men who assaulted me. And so, you know, there are a couple of instances where you see victims who are sort of like, look, this has already wrecked my life, and you know, I'm going to sort of use it for good, to the greatest extent possible. The other thing to note that's kind of interesting is that I interviewed a woman who just her freshman year at UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. who is an assault survivor herself, and basically said, I would be horrified if I knew that there were photos of what happened to me being circulated.
Sure.
But that said, you know, when she saw photos of another girl being assaulted and you know, people in her dorm laughing at it, she said, you know, she would have done what she could to sort of, like, circulate those photos to a broader audience, because she was like, I felt like that was the only thing that was going to get the university to act. And she was like, and clearly this guy, like, would have, you know, had done this before and would probably do it again. So she saw it more as like almost like a safety thing. And I know that, like, you know, I mean, I thought that was just super interesting, given that, you know, she told me that she's told almost no one about being assaulted herself, and yet was like, I see the case for publicizing photos of someone else's. So it's not easy even for survivors, I don't think, to sort of to make a judgment.
Yeah, as you're right, the line is really murky, and how people negotiate those things in their own heads and their own assaults and trying to maintain that public-private line is very interesting, especially where you feel like there's this social impetus to act to help other individuals. But at the end of the day, I think it's really sad that universities are so against taking action against these assailants. One would think that they wouldn't want these predators on their campus rather than trying to protect them and get involved in some type of scandal. But at the end of the day, I think the university has an obligation to protect the health of their students, because if they don't, their students aren't going to be there to do what they're supposed to do, which is to learn.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's tricky. There's a several campus complaint right now that's been brought, and ostensibly it's about campuses' failure to accurately report crime statistics.
Yes.
But essentially alleging that they don't follow up on cases like this precisely because they don't want the campus to get a reputation like, hey, this is a place where a lot of rapes happen, even though lots of campuses are places where lots of rapes happen.
Sure.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, the woman I interviewed, too, has not even told her parents that she was assaulted, because she was like, my parents would not let me go back to school at that campus. And at the end of the day, I love that campus, and I know it's no worse than anywhere else in, you know, in the country.
Sure.
So I think that, like, yeah, there's definitely this sense of, I don't know, that they have something to lose by following up, even though that's clearly not the case.
Well, Anne, I think that this story is really interesting because there's no really good or clear-cut answer as to what should happen with this type of media. And I think, as you said before, I think it will just keep being negotiated as culture changes to try to understand how do we place videos that document something that we consider to be inherently wrong with this need to protect other individuals and raise awareness. So thank you for writing this article, and thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for talking about it.
My pleasure. All right, everyone, that was Anne Friedman. We're going to play a little bit of music and then come back with Tom Berman. Be right back. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today, we have Tom Berman here with us. He's a political strategist, ready and willing to talk with us about my favorite sex scandal, the Anthony Weiner case. A lot has happened this week. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. I'm really excited to talk with you about this, and I know that you have a lot of really strong opinions on the subject, so let's get right into it.
It's been amusing to watch this New York mayor's race. I worked on the New York mayor's race 12 years ago for Mark Green, who eventually lost to Mike Bloomberg. I think it's a little bit unfortunate to see an important election like this kind of devolve into a tabloid story that's pretty much the same story every day, but at least it's been funny to watch unfold.
Oh, absolutely. So I first wanted to really get into this because you're a campaign staffer, and as you know, I've worked on Capitol Hill before, and as a campaign staffer or somebody who's worked for a political figure, I think we all know that it's our job, fundamentally, at the end of the day, to protect the reputation of our boss, because that is really what voters are voting on, whether or not they trust the individual and think they'll be effective. Obviously, whether or not the other candidate is a scrupulous person enters into it. But at the end of the day, it's your job to make sure that your candidate is not discredited. So I suggested last week that I didn't know, and this was sort of a joke to a certain degree, but I suggested to my listeners, why don't his staffers handle him? Put child protections on his computer. Don't let him have access to sites where he could put himself at risk. Why don't you think his staff is handling him better?
You know, I think that's a level of management into a candidate's sort of personal life that you really wouldn't hear about. I mean, that's just not really the relationship that elected officials and people running for office have with the people they work for. In large part, people who are running, I found a big motivation for people to get involved in politics and to run for office is to have a staff, to have subordinates, to have people that have to obey them, not the other way around. So, yeah, I mean, in most of my experience working with politicians or aspiring politicians, you would rarely see staff, consultants, campaign folks, anybody like that really get into their personal stuff at that level, even in a weird campaign situation like this.
Yeah, I guess the curious thing was maybe I had a more interesting situation, but we were all very candid with our boss. I mean, our boss was a very respectable, nice man, but at the same time, like, we would always joke around with him and we would be very forward with him. We would never handle him, but he never needed to be handled. But I would just assume that somebody, given his history, would have, maybe this is just my own opinion, would have sat down with him before all of this happened and said, what are you doing right now in your computer activities, and is there something we need to know?
I mean, my guess is that they had those conversations. I actually read some of this coverage that the campaign manager for Wiener quit when he quit when the recent revelations came out because they contradicted what Wiener had told him. That Wiener basically mm-hmm. lied to him about the timing of these further scandals that he did say at the beginning were going to come out or would likely come out.
Yeah.
So my guess is that at least the higher level folks working for him did have the conversations with him, and I think as we've seen with this guy, he just lied. You know, guys lies a lot.
No, it's really embarrassing that this Danny Kedem guy recently resigned. It's very embarrassing. I mean, he's a young man. He's had a pretty successful career thus far, and I think he has got a really good career ahead of him, and he basically said sayonara. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing either.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, I think what I'm interested, you know, what I find interesting, at least in terms of the psychology, is that, Wiener's not going to quit, even though now he's clearly going to lose. I tended to believe that he was going to lose anyway, that his sort of early poll numbers were sort of a reflection of people not tuning into the race until the last, the last few weeks, especially kind of always the case with the primary, that nobody really tunes in until the end and then they make decisions. But,
sure.
I mean, now it's really clear he's going to lose, and he's continuing to run anyway, and I think it's, you know, just in terms of psychology, a lot of people who run for office, they tend to, they tend to never say no to anything. I mean, that's sort of the way political campaigns go. There's an infinite number of things to do, and you sort of have to say yes to doing them all. Generally speaking, the successful or just the types that end up running for office and winning are people who just always say yes, always want to go to that one extra event, do that one extra, email. And so, it's interesting to watch that psychology Baker's decision to keep going.
Well, I'm more interested in the psychology of his narcissism, because clearly this man is a narcissist. I don't think anybody who has any understanding of psychology would not agree with me. But I wanted to delve into an issue that I think is really one of the more poignant points of this story, is that there have been multiple comparisons being made between Wiener and Abedin and the Clintons. And essentially, Huma is the political wife and also has a Tammy Wynette complex, as my good guest beforehand, Anne Friedman, said in her article this week in The New Yorker, and as I said last week on my show. So do you think that these comparisons between Abedin and the Clintons are fair? My opinion is thus far that Wiener's no Clinton and Huma is no Hillary. So what do you think?
I think I think it's a fair thing to talk about because, you know, their wedding was kind of staged to be a political boost for Wiener's career. You know, it was almost the American equivalent of like a state wedding. It clearly wasn't just about two people in love wanting to get married. It was about, you know, self-promotion with political design. I think comparing one sex scandal to another, I think this is kind of more interesting. It's just, we're kind of living in an age of narcissism, social media, and cameras attached to everything, and, cameras that are literally pointed at you on all of your devices. And, Anthony Weiner, unfortunately, is probably something of a pioneer. He's really just the first person to get mired in a sex scandal this way. You'll probably see stories that are variations on this one down the line.
Okay. Well, what's interesting, I guess, I know that this was obviously a very calculated political marriage. At the same time, I don't think that there's the same degree of political clout holding her into this marriage that there was into holding Hillary into Bill's marriage. Bill Clinton was president of the United States. Anthony Weiner is an ex-congressman turned mayoral primary candidate in New York City. Huma Abedin is not the First Lady of the United States. And while I think that she's ambitious politically and very intelligent, I don't think that she's Hillary Clinton or has maybe the same ambitions as Hillary Clinton. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know. She hasn't, said that much really about what's going on between the two of them or what motivates them to stay together. She's been talking, in sort of political campaign or PR speak. But I know they have a kid together, so
yes,
that's a complicating factor. And I guess, it would certainly be very defensible. It would certainly be a very defensible decision for her to make to just say, hey, we're going to weather all of this sort of political media nonsense and, get through it and then try to figure out what comes next.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the reason that she stays is, threefold. I think that she does have a very young child. I believe the child is approximately 2 years old, if not a little younger. And I think she genuinely loves him. I don't think that you would be able to put up with this if you didn't genuinely love them or at least have a high level of reverence for them to some degree. And then I think it's also this political factor, as you have been pointing out, that's keeping her standing by her man.
I think it's probably a very complicated position to be in. But again, I think, everybody in this story kind of comes from a level of the political world where you tend not to reach that if you're willing to quit on things for better or for worse.
Absolutely. And I mean, the interesting point about her maintaining this political speak, as you said, was that when you watch her at the press conference, I think that while she's very ticked off at him and arguably, wants to rip off his testicles and play tennis with them, that she's more upset about having to continue to justify her actions, his behavior, and answer questions in the public spotlight. It doesn't seem to me that she wants to be a very public figure, at least not in this arena.
Yeah, that's a vivid image, certainly. I don't know. I think it kind of cuts both ways. Because again, what always kind of struck me was just sort of the nature of when they got married, what the media spectacle they turned it into. That sort of to me subverts the idea that she's extremely private person. But I don't know either way.
Well, I wonder. I mean, that part makes me wonder if it was him or her. And obviously, we'll never know. I wonder if it was more him wanting to be public than her. I have no idea. Nor do any of us, honestly, unless we ask them. But I don't think she's going to tell us. But I wanted to ask you another question. We've heard about all of these political redemption cases, and most recently, Mark Sanford. Think about Newt Gingrich. All of these people that have been able to make a comeback, per se. why do you think Wiener wasn't able to, other than this? Because you said initially that you didn't think that he'd be able to win the primary. Why do you think that he couldn't, other than this one instance, which is obviously huge, make a comeback?
Yeah, I think it's a little harder for Democrats to come back from these things than it is for Republicans. I mean, mm-hmm. Democrats, you know, I'm a Democrat. I'm pretty far out there on the left in terms of my personal political beliefs. But I get frustrated when other Democrats tell me that these sex scandals don't matter and that they should just be ignored because, you know, as Democrats, we're making this argument that we know how to make society run better, that we know how to make things more fair, that we... we've got some level of wisdom we're bringing to the table, some level of wisdom in the pursuit of social justice. Republicans don't say that. Republicans basically says the other guys are crooks, mm-hmm. and we're going to stop them.
Yeah,
and that's it. That's all they got. That's all they're really asking for. I mean, there's differences on some of the other issues like national security, but in general. Democrats are asking people to believe a little bit more. And so when you do something like a Wiener or Spitzer that subverts this image that you're trying to put forward, it's harder to bounce back from it. You know, David Vitter, on the other hand, or Sanford, you know, these guys aren't really promising us anything from government. They're just, they're just saying, vote for me and I'll keep the schmucks in Washington in line.
Well, Tom, that's an interesting point. I try to keep our show fairly apolitical in that, and I'm a registered independent. But I would say that one thing that's interesting that my best friend always says about these political sex scandals, and I think that he's always right about it, is that, and this isn't a partisan thing, but he's like, the Republicans always double down. When they've had something like this happen, they said, yes, I committed an affair, and then I committed an affair with her sister, too, and face it. And that's what I did, and they own it. I think the Democrats don't want to own their sex scandals. I think that's really part of the issue, that they don't want to own it and be like, yeah, we did that and we're going to do this too and I'm going to keep doing it, but I'm running the government and that's it. They own it. I don't think Democrats own it.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the whole Clinton experience, and I think most Democrats feel like that what Bill Clinton did as president was gross, but that the prosecution and the sort of two-year process of sidetracking the entire national conversation over the Lewinsky affair was not a good thing.
I think both Democrats and Republicans and independents think that was a bad thing too.
I think that's where this attitude that sex scandals shouldn't matter comes from. I just think it, in a lot of cases, wishful thinking.
Fair enough. Well, Tom, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks. It was fun.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, y'all. That was Tom Berman, political strategist. Robbie Kramer actually called in and said he couldn't be with us today, but will be with us next week. I'm going to play a little bit of music, and then we're going to get into my dating advice for the week. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had Tom Berman on, who's a political strategist, here to talk to us about his take on the Huma Abedin Anthony Weiner case. And now we're going to get into my dating advice of the week. This week's topic is, what are the top 5 first date don'ts? Okay. First dates are really never fun. If you're a serial first dater, like my mother calls me, you definitely know this. However, there are some major violations of the first date code that can be and should be avoided at all costs. First lesson, musical chairs. You should always sit across from your date. As I've said before, eye contact is critical. You might not be Paul Newman or Robert Redford, but it's possible for you to seduce your date with your eyes. Eye contact is also really critical for establishing trust. Never, ever, ever, ever attempt to sit next to your date at a restaurant. I'm not arguing that there's this force field around your date's chair, but sitting next to somebody confers a level of intimacy that's really not appropriate yet. And more importantly, you're sending a hand signal. And I don't mean stop, go, etc. I mean, I'm sending a signal that I want to use my hands. Second, time's a wasting. While we live in a world that's unpredictable, you can, with reasonable certainty, project how long it's going to take from getting to, from point A to point B, unless you're accounting for accidents on the subway or some type of crash on the 405. But leave 10 minutes early and try to be on time. Third, mirror, mirror. On a first date, you should always be complimentary. If you think that a girl's attractive, tell her that you think she looks like. Don't tell her that she's hot, gorgeous, cute, or has a nice butt. Trust me, she spends enough time at the gym to know that her tush looks nice. And while you remember, you think you're being, you know, nice or sweet, by emphasizing these physical things, you are really objectifying your date to a certain degree. Remember, your date is not a piece of filet mignon and you're not at the butcher. Fourth, location. Pick a location that's not convenient for your date. Choose a location that is an hour away from her home, resulting in her schlepping across town in rush hour traffic. Trust me, battling cars and other commuters is not an aphrodisiac. If you do not live very close to your date and are unwilling to drive to her area, pick a place in the middle. Remember, all is fair in love and war. Fourth, parting words. At the end of the date, don't say something like, see you soon or see you later. Man up and say, I had a nice time. Talk to you soon. And if you don't intend to ask the individual out on a second date, you can either address it at that moment or tell them it was just nice to meet them. We actually got a text while I was talking from our listener in Studio City, Phil, who asked, what do you say to a girl if she isn't cute? Tell her that you like her outfit. She might not be attractive, but you're complimenting her outfit rather than her physical persona itself. That's Dr. Jess's advice for the week. Next week, we're going to be coming back and have Robbie Kramer, our dating coach, and several other guests. I'm really excited. Remember, y'all, don't fake it.